Everybody, it's sort of a little lull in conversation, so I'll take the opportunity to welcome you back for day two of our workshop. Our first day was very exciting. We had a lively discussion. I think we're talking about a lot of different themes are swirling around, and I think that's what was meant to happen. It wasn't supposed to, we weren't trying to have too guided of a conversation, so some things that we want to return to probably by the end of the day. And if for some reason you need to leave and you want to email us or contact us with your thoughts or opinions or voice any concerns you might have, we'd be happy to receive those via email or any other way you want to communicate with us. We have a charge to try to think of some measures that might be included on an already existing health survey. So we just want everyone to keep that in mind. What would be a few questions, few ranges from 1 to 5, it seems like. I think I'm not at this point, I think it's okay to keep it a little broad. But just to think about, so we can return to this, what would, if you could just ask a few questions, what would they be? So that, we've talked about that yesterday. We had some nice conversation that I think will continue today about linking administrative data and trying to think about how we can capitalize or leverage some of the data that are out there by joining them together. So if that's something that we want to consider as a possibility for conversation and thought. And then we have some larger issues about what does the field need if we really want to understand maybe some of the causal mechanisms or what creates, what are the mechanisms underlying poor health or positive health outcomes? How could we best measure that in surveys? And so we sort of have these three themes, and Rashida nicely sent us an email outlining these for us this morning, so I think her sort of tiers of activity are helpful for us to think about as we go about the day, and we'll try to return to these during the wrap-up. Our first session this morning, we're fortunate to have Michael Schober from the New School, who was on the phone in the morning. His little there was a little figure of you. You weren't actually on the screen. And he was watching us. So he has some idea of how the conversation went yesterday and has kindly agreed to facilitate this section that includes some data sets, some representatives from different data sets that are ongoing that are part of the Department of Health and Human Services, a group of strong health surveys, some of their core surveys. And I will, Michael, do you want to introduce people as we go along, or do you want me to? Or
whatever you like.
Okay. All right. I'll turn it over to Michael, and then okay. We will have every person is going to give a little presentation, an insightful presentation about their data set, and then we'll open it up for discussion.
Okay. All right. Thanks, everybody. Really glad to be here and be part of this really important project. So thanks very much. And I'm sorry I wasn't able to be here in person yesterday, but delighted to see you all in person today. So the agenda here is for representatives from each of these ongoing and amazing surveys to talk about and explain to us who don't know as much about them what exactly happens in them and who the constituencies are and all that kind of stuff, and that to open up the door for moving forward. Why don't we just go in the order that's on the program and start with Marcy Sinema from NHIS on the NCHS survey.
Thanks. Good morning. I'm going to talk to you about the National Health Interview Survey, one of the largest and oldest health surveys run by the department. For anyone who doesn't know what it is, I'll just tell you a little bit about what it is today, and then I'll tell you about what it is evolving toward. The purpose of the Health Interview Survey is to be a general population survey of the non-institutionalized civilian population and to collect a broad range of topics pertinent to the department and to public health. The sample is a multi-stage probability sample. We have recently converted to an address-based sample purchased from a vendor. And the there are at least two primary sampling units in each state, so we can produce state-level estimates on a wide range of variables, but not everything from the survey and not on all populations. The mode is in person, and there is some telephone follow-up, but we try to stress the importance of the in-person interview as a unique feature of the health interview survey. But about 22% of the interviews are completed by phone. They're at least initiated in person. Data collection has been continuous since 1957 when the survey started, and we do produce quarterly files and reports on a subset of variables from the survey and annual files with as many variables as we can produce based on non-disclosure risk. Variables that do pose disclosure risk are available through the National Center for Health Statistics Research Data Center through an application process. The base target of the sample is 35,000 households per year. The past 4 years, we have been fortunate enough to have supplementary funding from the department, from various sources, in order to increase the sample size to about 43,000 completed interviews per household to improve our state level estimates, especially targeted to the impact of the Affordable Care Act. We do link the HIS data to other sources of information from CMS, from HUD, the National Death Index, and we are exploring other linkages as well. So it was a little hard to decide how to discuss the HIS since we are a survey in transition. But from 1997 until 2017, the format has been kind of a three-phase type of survey where the first 20 minutes, 20 to 30 minutes, are a family-level interview where information about the entire household is collected and a person, a knowledgeable respondent, answers some health questions about everyone. And then one adult and one child, if there are children in the household, are randomly selected for a more detailed interview of approximately 20 minutes each. And then we have supplemental information questions that pertain usually to the sample adult and sometimes to the sample child that add another 20 to 30 minutes. But we're being redesigned. And there are a number of reasons for this. One is because health systems have changed in this country a lot since 1997. The questionnaire has gotten way too long and cumbersome and unwieldy and redundant, but we have not removed content for fear of monkeying with the estimates that are produced annually. So we have avoided removing questions, but we have not avoided adding questions. So the goal of the redesign is to really improve the measurement of the covered topics, and I'll talk more about those covered topics later, and to reduce respondent burden. I will demonstrate why that is very important. To harmonize with other surveys in the department, there's a major initiative. ASPE is very much involved, as is the HHS Data Council, to harmonize or align content so that surveys that ask similar questions or ask similar subjects do so in a comparable way. And to establish a long-term structure for ongoing and periodic topics. We have in the past and will continue in the future to have standardized topics on an annual basis and then to rotate topics on and off, either sponsored or topics that NCHS supports. We also plan on trying to incorporate over, not maybe in 2018 with when the redesign is launched, but eventually biomeasures of various sorts through some sort of passive monitoring approach. We're still exploring the possibilities, and the field is evolving so rapidly that we're waiting for just the right device to come along. Our timeline, we have been in an outreach mode for the past couple of years and continue to do that, and we'll continue for the rest of this year. We plan to finalize the questionnaire by the end of this year, and then work on the systems to support the new questionnaire. We have reached out to our data users through our listserv, through our sponsors. We've had professional associations send lots of emails out to their membership about some plans that we have to rearrange the survey, and have gotten hundreds of suggestions that we'll try to accommodate as best we can. So I want to go to the next one. I mentioned it a little bit about one of the reasons we need to redesign the questionnaire is that it's gotten too long. As you can see from this great illustration, the length of the questionnaire has gone from about 48 minutes to over 100 minutes. And this has seriously hurt our response rates. We used to have response rates in the high 90s, and now we're, for the family section, in the low 70s, and the adult section, again, low 70s, which doesn't do well. We're supposed to be the gold standard for many of the topics that we collect, and can only do that if we have good response rates. So the proposed structure for the survey in the future, beginning in 2018, is to have a very brief set of questions about the family. It used to be that we had 20 to 30 minutes about the family. Now we're just going to a structure where we will get some very basic demographics in order to select a sample adult and sample child, to get enough about the family's income and program participation so that we can develop federal poverty level information and some health insurance. The focus of the interview will be the sample adult and the sample child. The purpose of this is because the proxy information is not as good as sample adult and sample child. In the literature, the family section, other than health insurance and income, were really underutilized. I would say close to 95% of the publications are based on sample adult and sample child, and very, very little from family other than what I mentioned. So that's why we're pushing the focus down to these two respondents. Well, a parent or guardian will answer for the child. But the way it is currently is that it takes a long time to get into the health questions because you're collecting so much about the structure of the household and contact information and other topics. And with this new approach, we can launch right into health questions after just a couple of minutes, and that will be more engaging for our respondents, we feel, and help us improve our response rates. The break-off or the loss of respondents from family to sample adult now is really quite painful. So in the redesign, there will be core questions that appear every year, and they will be about a little bit about the household, and then the sample adult, sample child. There will be rotating modules that are also considered core, which means that NCHS supports that portion of the survey as well. And these will be topics like, if we have a couple of questions for the sample adult on tobacco use in the annual, we might have much more detail every few years about quit attempts and initiation of tobacco use, say, on these rotating modules. Similar detail would exist for other health behaviors. We've also considered for rotating modules more detail on, say, rare conditions that we don't feel are important to ask every single year. A lot of things are fairly stable, and they're not needed as covariates on an annual basis. So we've really taken a critical look at what absolutely needs to be there, what the HIS should be on an annual basis, and what we can live with on a less frequent basis. Additionally, supplemental modules are those questions that are supported by our sponsors, and those are usually federal agencies, although sometimes they're foundations. And most of these agencies are within the Department of Health and Human Services, although we've partnered with other agencies as well. We have in the past allowed a supplement to be up to an average of 20 minutes. We had a lot of problems with spikes in non-response those years when we had very lengthy supplements. So we are now limiting supplements to no more than 5 minutes, and it's not measured as a median or on a median basis, but on how long it takes to read every single question as you go through it. As you mentioned yesterday, that in surveys where you can screen people, you know, half the people out and just focus your questions on a subset of the population, it costs less. Well, it wasn't costing us less to do that, in that we were losing respondents, and it still costs the same amount to support those questions on the infrastructure of the survey. So now our supplements will be from one question, as little as one question, to up to 5 minutes of actually read through each question. And this is making our sponsors that used to do 20-minute average topics think about how to parse that into smaller components over maybe every year or every other year, and it's making them take a more critical look at the topics that they support. The other thing that it's doing is when we calculated by average, we ended up with interviews that took hours. You know, for elderly people or people with particular conditions, what was an average of 100 minutes for some people was literally 3 hours for others, and it just became an impossible situation to deal with. So I mentioned earlier that how we will be deciding what is to be supported on the core. Here are the criteria that we are using to judge each and every question that we are going to support on an annual and rotating basis. So I won't read through it. You can see what the criteria are, and they would be probably the standard for anybody thinking about how to reduce a questionnaire by 30%, which is, you know, it's a painful cut. We've made a lot of thumbs down, you know, unlikes. But, you know, it hurts. It hurts us too to have to cut this much. But we feel it's an important activity to undergo for the survey as we really think through what it should be for the next 10 to 20 years. So To learn more about the redesign, we have a website that you can go to submit comments to us, which means it goes to me. My name is Health Surveys. It is. Please, feel free to send your thoughts about the redesign to us. We do read every single email and think hard about whether we can meet the requests of our data users. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much. All right. So next we have on the phone, I believe we do, right, Wayne Giles, director of BRFSS, Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System at the CDC. Wayne, can you hear us?
I sure can. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Great.
Perfect.
All right. So, take it away.
Okay. Thanks. It's a great pleasure to be here and to talk with you all today. And I love following Marcy because you'll see a lot of similarities between what the National Health Interview Survey does and what we do as part of the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. So I just want to clarify one thing in my introduction. Dr. Michelle Towne is actually the leader for the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. I am the director of the Division of Population Health, and the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, or BRFS, is within my division. So I know Jordan and others have been interacting with Dr. Towne with that. So if you go to the next slide, this talks a little bit about the BRFS. So the BRFS has been in existence since 1984, and really the reason we created the surveillance system was because we realized that while we had great national data, such as the National Health Interview Survey and NHANES and others you're going to hear about, states really didn't have data that they needed. And, you know, I like to say all public health and health promotion is local. And so there was a call for surveillance at the state level. And so the BRFS is a joint partnership between CDC and states. And the content and other things are jointly developed and agreed to by both CDC and the states. It's a phone survey, and we include both landline and cell phones, and I'll talk a little bit about that in just a minute. And we ask about a whole series of health conditions and health behaviors. We ask about healthcare utilization. The other thing that's nice about the BRFS is it's very flexible. And so as emerging issues come up, it's relatively easy with some discussions with leadership to get questions added to the survey. And we do over 450,000 interviews each year. And that allows us, a unique thing about the BRFS is in addition to the state level data, we can also provide national estimates, we can provide county estimates, and now we can provide census tract estimates as well. So literally with one surveillance system, you can get estimates from the census tract all the way up to the national level. So that's sort of a nice aspect of the BRFS. If you go to the next slide, I'll talk a little bit about the components of the BRFS. So there's a core component, very similar to what Marcy talked about with the National Health Interview Survey. So these are questions that are asked by all of the states and all of the territories. There's an annual core where questions are asked every year, and then there's a rotating core, and I'll go through the content for both the annual and rotating core in just a minute. And then in addition to that, we have optional modules. These are where programs across CDC, HHS, but also other federal agencies sponsor anywhere from 1 to 10 questions that are an optional module, and states can decide whether or not they want to ask the questions that are part of the module. And so some modules are asked by all of the states. We've got a module on diabetes that's asked by all of the states and the territories. We've got other modules that are only asked by 1 or 2 states. Some states will decide at the end of the survey to add their own state-added questions. That's not part, those data don't come to CDC for processing, and those data aren't part of the public use data set as part of the work. And then finally, we do a series of special project additions. So, you know, whether it's H1N1, asthma, and others, where we will have a series of questions where programs will just ask us to do sort of an add-on, a special special set of questions that we'll ask on an as-needed basis. So just wanted to bring that up as well. These are the topics that are in the core survey. So immunizations, HIV, diabetes. You can see all of the topics that are part of the core survey. These questions are asked every year. If you go to the next slide. These are the demographic questions that we ask, so age, gender, race, ethnicity, marital status, employment status, disability, income, et cetera. Those are the demographic questions that are part of the survey. Next slide. These are the questions that are part of the rotating core. So again, these are questions that are asked every year. That are asked by all of the states and the territories, and either on even year or odd numbered years, these questions are asked as well. And then on the next slide, you can see the optional modules that we ask. So adult asthma, anxiety, arthritis, et cetera, et cetera. I did want to bring your attention to a module that we have called the Reactions to Race module, which asks questions about specifically around issues around discrimination. We've had anywhere from 2 to 3 states asking that to 13 states asking the Reactions to Race module. But I did want you to know there are a series of questions that get at issues around discrimination that I thought might be interesting for you all as well. And then if you go on to the next slide, I did want to talk a little bit about trends in the BRFS. So you know, we look at sort of our median response rate, which is about 67%. You know, I think one of the keys is getting folks on the phone, and then frequently the hardest part is getting folks to answer the phone. But once we get folks to answer the phone, our interviewers do a pretty good job about keeping them and retaining them in the system. I did want to also mention that about a third of our interviews are being done via cell phone, but in some of the states it's up to 60%. We are really pushing the cell component a part of the interview, and we're seeing rapid changes going on there. We actually are able to keep people on the cell phone longer than we are on the landline component, which is sort of an interesting aspect of what we do. The last slide I did want to show you is sort of who uses the data. And so state and local, primarily governmental health departments, use it, CDC programs, other agencies, policymakers. I also did want to mention, because of the ability to analyze the BRFS at multiple levels of jurisdiction, we do see groups like America's Health Rankings, which rank where the states are with data, county health rankings, where they rank where the healthiest counties in the U.S. and what they're doing. We now have a new project called 500 Cities, where we're going to be going down to the census tract to do that. So we do see all of those groups using the BRFS data as well. And then the final slide I have is just a thank you for the opportunity to talk with folks today. And I did want to give you the website, which is www.cdc.gov/BRFS. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Wayne. Great. So, excuse me. Next, we have Arthur Hughes from SAMHSA.
All right, thanks everyone for being here. It's really a pleasure to, thank you very much for allowing me to come and talk about the NISDA. It's really been a very exciting discussion, and I look forward to talking more about NISDA. What I have today is just sort of basic set of slides that talk about the design. There's a lot of information about the sample design, information about the timing of the survey, and I do have what I think are most of the questions that we have on criminal justice involvement. So let me just dive right into this. If I can get this to work here. Okay. Hope. There you go. All right, so what is NISDA? NISDA is basically the primary source of information on substance use and mental health issues in the U.S. So that's the primary purpose of NISDA, to collect data on substance use, mental health, and associated behaviors. Survey's been in existence since 1971 as part of it kind of sprung out of the National Marijuana Commission back in the early 70s. It's morphed into various different types of things over the years, including in 1999 when we expanded the sample from national sample to a state sample. We sponsored a survey. It's run by us in the Center for Behavioral Health, Statistics, and Quality, and we have a contractor that collects the data. The staffing is about 13 people now, so we're very limited in what we can do in-house, so we have to contract out. So as I mentioned, it's a national survey. We also collect state, and we can get sub-state estimates, not exactly down to the track level, but we can get, in some cases, county or collection of county-level estimates. We can identify correlates. We do use the arrest information we get on arrest and probation and parole as correlates to look at associations with drug use. One of the key strengths of NISDA is to measure trends, and that information is used by Office of National Drug Control Policy, by Healthy People 2020, to monitor trends and objectives that they have in place. So the target population is the civilian, non-institutionalized population, age 12 or older, 50 states and D.C. We include all households, basically, college dorms, shelters, homeless shelters. That doesn't mean we can produce estimates in homeless shelters or migratory work camps, but they are part of the target population. We exclude active military, long-term hospital residents, prison populations, and homeless not in shelters. So the design is basically a state-based design and deeply stratified. It's a multi-stage area probability sample. We start with at the state level. States are the first level of stratification. We have strata within each state. It depends on the size of the state itself, but we have strata to allow the sample to be dispersed across the state. Then we select census tracts and block groups within tracts, segments, which are collections of blocks. When we get down to the segments, we send out listers to actually canvas the area to count lists, and that's the basis for selecting sample units. So that list goes back to the statisticians, who then will select a sample dwelling units. And the last stage is we select either one or two people in the households. We do oversample people aged 12 to 25. So just a little bit more about the state characteristics. We really have five groups of states, ranging from California, which has the largest population, down to the smallest states, which are grouped in that last row, the remaining 38 states in D.C. And it basically forms a allocation that's proportionate to the size, sampling proportionate to the size. So basically the larger the state, the larger the sample, except for the 38 small states, what we call the small states. We have a fixed sample of 960. And as you can see the column next to the last, where it's the cluster size, and it's a little different, but for each of the groups of states, but we try to get at least 10 respondents in each cluster. Okay, this just gives illustration of how the samples disperse. So each of those green dots, I think the green that they look on the screen there, represents the PSU at a segment. Back here. Okay, so we have 96 of these across. We have 12 different strata, as you can see by the lines for Iowa. And within each one, there are eight segments selected, proportionate to size. So as you can see, the sample is pretty much dispersed across the U.S., but across the state. There are some clustering, as you can see, in areas that have high populations. All right, so it's a two-phase sample. We have a screening phase where it's a personal interview survey. So it's a screening phase where the interviewer, after a letter sent out a week before to the sampled address, the interviewer would then knock on the door and talk about the survey and try to gain participation. If the screen respondent does say yes, then a short screener is done. It's about 5 minutes to get basic demographic information and determine who is eligible to be selected in the sample. Right now, we have a response rate at the screening level about 82%. So if the respondent agrees to participate, then interview would take place. It's about, right now, we're hovering around 71%, and as Marcy indicated, our response rates have been dipping as well. We do offer a $30 cash incentive, and we've offered that since 2002. But in our case, you know, the incentives has been constant over time. The questions have changed, but we're still seeing a drastic decline in response rates. That is a concern. So I'm going to jump right into the criminal justice involvement questions. There are a bunch of questions we can talk about later if you like. As I said, most of the questions deal with substance use, mental health disorders. But I'm just going to jump right into the section that we call the special topic section. And the questions, what you see here is pretty much what's in the questionnaire. Some of the things like intro SP, SP, that's really the specifications. Respondents don't really see that. But they do see the opening sentence there. The next questions are about encounters with the police or the court system, not counting minor traffic violations. Have you ever been arrested and booked for breaking the law? And then we explain what book means. And we get a simple yes or no. So if respondent says yes, then they'll get subsequent questions on how many arrests, how many times over the past 12 months have been arrested. And the subsequent questions are, starting with that question, are about the past 12 months. That's the recency period that we use for all of the questions in this module, for the most part. All right. Then once we get past that question, SPO2, then we have a series of questions about specific arrests. So, and again, about the past 12 months. So we ask, in the past 12 months, were you arrested and booked for motor vehicle theft? And it's yes, no, or don't know, refuse. Then we ask about 16 or 15 other types of arrests. And these are based on the FBI's list of offenses. There's been a little bit of tweaking of these questions over time. They've been on the survey since 1996. So they've been around for a while, and again, a little bit of tweaking there. But so each of those 16 that you see, from number 2 for larceny or theft all the way to fraud, possessing stolen goods, or vandalism, they get the same wording there. In the past 12 months, were you arrested and booked for fraud, possessing stolen goods, or vandalism, et cetera. Then the last question, 17, we ask for some other offense, and we give the respondent an opportunity to write in. And we see responses like violation of probation, of probation or parole, gambling, traffic tickets. And there are a number of writing responses that actually correspond to one of the offenses. So in that case, we'll just impute them into the right category. All right, then the last two questions we have are, were you on probation at any time in the past 12 months? And were you on parole, supervised release, other conditional release, past 12 months? Now, there are a few other questions in that module, but these are the essential questions that involve criminal justice. Okay, so what I have here is over a 7-year period from 2008 to 2014, these are annual average weighted prevalence estimates for ever arrested. So remember the question about ever arrested? That's asked for everyone 12 or older. I should mention this module is asked for everyone 12 or older. We get a weighted estimate of 16.8%, 82.9% says no. And since the question is about response rates, we get about a 0.3% missing out of this group. Over the 7-year period, we get about 480,000 respondents age 12 or older, out of which about 67,000 said yes to the ever arrested question. 15,000 say yes, they were in probation over the past 12 months. 4,400 indicated they're on parole or supervised release. And again, this is over a 7-year period. So see, in terms of the missingness, there's a very low missingness there. I should mention, I don't have the missingness indicated for the specific offenses. It varies. It's approximately about 1%, but it's a little trickier there because the prevalence of those offenses are very low in some cases, like prostitution. We don't get a lot of cases, it's not a high percentage. And the actually missing rate is actually a little higher than the percentage of people who said that, you know, they were arrested for that particular offense. So that, and we don't impute, so that's a little, it could be a little problematic there. Okay, so this slide shows the, this is for the 2015 survey, and it shows the average questionnaire time in minutes. So we try to get the, we try to keep the samples, the questionnaire within 60 minutes. That's been something that's been in place for many years. We feel that we've tried, if we increase that, it's going to have an impact on response burden, and we may run into even further declines in response rate. So we're very cautious about if you add questions, to make sure we keep within 60 minutes. Right now we have 58.7 minutes, and what you see right below the R respondents is probation, parole, and not respondents not. So if all of, so the 63.9% minutes is the amount of time it takes to people on parole to answer all of the questions, not only just the special topic section, but the whole questionnaire, just to give you some perspective there. So you can see the parolees, actually, it takes longer for them to answer a question. A lot of it's because of their drug, their substance use, and they spend a lot of time in abuse dependence modules. So that's the reason for that. The last column talks about the it displays the number of minutes for the special topic section I just mentioned. So while this whole survey is a little under 60 minutes, overall, all respondents take about a little over 1 minute. And probation respondents take a little bit around, and parolees take about 2 minutes. So it doesn't take a lot of time for that. And, you know, basically the parolees and probationer people, they constitute about 3 to 4% of the sample. So, you know, adding a couple different additional minutes will not affect the total. But there are other issues that we can talk about later that we think are important to address before we even consider adding questions or expanding that module. So I think that's my last slide. I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor.
Thanks very much. Now, Anjani Chandra from NCHS.
Hello, I'm Anjani Chandra, and I am, let's wait for the actual slides to materialize. Thank you. Hi, I am team lead for the group within NCHS that conducts the National Survey of Family Growth, and I'd like to give you just a little bit of background on why we do this survey and why we do it at NCHS and why we do it in the Division of Vital Statistics. And I will end with just showing you the couple of questions that we do ask in our mail survey. We only ask questions in the mail survey right now about incarceration experience. And so I'll show you what those are. Unfortunately, I did not have a chance to bring some results with me about those, but we can talk about that later. So starting with why we do the National Survey of Family Growth. It is done at NCHS because the Section 306 of the Public Health Service Act, going back to 1944, stipulated that NCHS shall collect statistics on family formation, growth, and dissolution. It took until 1973 for that survey to be formalized as the NSFG done within the federal sector. Other versions of the survey had been done in the private sector, and that was when it was brought into the federal statistical system. Our primary purpose has been to explain variations in the birth rates. And so that kind of provides the rationale for why we are situated in the Division of Vital Statistics in the Reproductive Statistics Branch. So in that branch are two teams, NSFG team and then the birth team. So our function has primarily been over the years, our core function for this survey has been to explain what we are seeing with the birth rates. And in that regard, we have our primary survey content is organized around the proximate determinants of fertility, looking at factors that directly affect the occurrence of sexual activity, the occurrence of pregnancy from that sexual activity, and the occurrence of a live birth from that pregnancy. So we are organized around factors about various details about sexual activity, and then issues like contraception and infertility, pregnancy loss, and so forth, that it would impact the occurrence of a birth. And then we are also about collecting information on demographic and socioeconomic factors that may relate to those behaviors that relate to fertility. So we get information on race, ethnicity, religion, education, all of these factors that and family structure that may play a part in those intermediate variables. Over the years, as our scope of the survey has broadened into including non-married, never married people, as well as currently married, we've sort of, and we also added, and as I'll show you in just a second, brought men into the survey, which only happened in 2002. This content of the survey has moved to capturing risk factors for HIV and sexually transmitted diseases, as well as factors related to non-marital fertility. And then, as I mentioned, a fundamental part of the survey is to describe family formation, growth, and dissolution. So we collect, in addition to our complete pregnancy history, marriage, divorce, and cohabitation information, and more recently, the information we have about fathers and their roles in raising children. I don't know if any of you are familiar with a report that we published quite recently, just in the last couple of weeks, describing some of our attitude data, but we do have a lot of information about the American people's, in this age range, 15 to 44, attitudes about sex, marriage, and parenthood, and a report on that came out, misquoted all over the place, but there it is. It's amazing what they drew from it. But okay, so this is just an overview of all of the NSOGs that have been conducted to date. As I say, we started NCHS back in 1973, and at that time, the survey was only conducted with ever-married women, primarily currently married women, but also ever-married if they've had children. And you can sort of see the oversamples laid out there as well. 1982 was the first time women were included in the survey regardless of their marital experience. And then 2002 was the first time we included an independent sample of men. So these are not couples data. This is a sample of women and a sample of men age 15 to 44. And then in 2006, we transitioned from a periodically conducted survey to continuous fieldwork design. And we've been in that mode pretty much since with a brief, well, not so brief, but about a year's break in order to let the award the new contract, which University of Michigan got again, as you can see by the long-term University of Michigan shown there. So where we are now, pretty much since 2006, is that we're using a design which is called responsive design, in which we're always in the field, theoretically, and we can be much more efficient with our funding for the survey. So we have found that with that design where we use daily paradata, markers for fieldwork effort, we can reallocate fieldwork dollars to be the most efficient, and we have been able to reduce our fieldwork to cost to such an extent that it costs 80%. We get 80% more cases for about 1/3 of the cost. Let's see. So right now we are also in a position where we're releasing public use data files roughly every 2 years from continuous design. So our last file, 2011 to 13, which despite the years on that, it's actually 2 years worth of data because we go September to September. But that two-year file was released in December 2014. And later this fall, we'll be releasing a 13 to 15 public use file. So instead of laying out the full content of the survey in much detail, I thought it would be better to show you who supports the survey, because that in its sense is a peek into what is guiding our content. The first three that you see in bold are pretty much supporting the entire survey, and their interests are much broader, perhaps. NCHS itself, the NICHD, the Demographic and Population, I don't know what their actual name is right now, but the branch that does demographic and health sciences, whatever they're called right now. And then Office of Population Affairs is very much supporting our Title 10 clinic data that we collect in the survey. So we have a handle on not only what services women may be receiving for family planning and other medical reasons, but whether they're going to Title 10 funded providers for those services. Children's Bureau is very much interested in our survey for information on adoption and foster care, and more recently in looking at children or adults who may have had experience living in shelters or otherwise being homeless. And then, as you can see from the wide array of CDC's divisions, there is a big push to monitor STD and HIV risk, as well as different experiences with cancer screening, prevention, like mammography is primarily what we ask about because of the Cancer Prevention and Control's interest in breast cancer risk factors. The Division of Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities, their interest in our survey has been in, and you may have seen it recently because it was published as a CDC vital sign, the potential for alcohol-exposed pregnancies among women. Again, another unfortunate misquoting of a result, but there you have it. That's a danger we have when we try to put out neutral findings, which may not seem so neutral. And more recently, we've added the Division of Adolescent and School Health to our funding group, and their interest is, as you may be aware, they do the YRBS with Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which is very much focused on children, teens in school. And so, but they're very much concerned with children who may not be in school. And so they're supporting our survey as well. How is the survey conducted? This is just a little more detail. And thanks to Art here, I don't have to go showing you pictures because you can imagine how the screener is done because it's very similar. The NSFG is a household-based survey, just as the NSDUH is and HIS that you heard before. So we conduct a household screener to locate the eligibles, which up until September 2015 was 15 to 44, but we've recently expanded our age range to 15 to 49. So we only interview one person in that age range per household. And the reason for that is that we're concerned about the confidentiality, potential for confidentiality breaches if we interview, say, parent-child spouses and so forth, because they will, the greatest risk for disclosure is in knowing that someone's been interviewed in the survey, and then potentially even with public use files, you could identify your husband's record or your son's record and so forth. So this is face-to-face interviewing done with laptop computers, much like this one right here. In fact, almost exactly like that one right there. And so we have an 80-minute interview for females and 60 minutes for males. And that includes for both men and women about 15 to 20 minutes of audio CASI content. That's the self-administered portion. That is the section that, while the entire interview may have a lot of sensitive content, that holds our most sensitive content, including the criminal involvement question, actually the incarceration. I won't say criminal involvement because, as you'll see in a second, we don't have anywhere near what your survey is asking. All of our interviews are done by highly skilled female interviewers. They're trained specifically on NSFG for 1 week. The reason I mention that is that they're trained very specifically on techniques of refusal, aversion, and they don't say conversion in the NSFG or at NCHS because of the ethical issues around that term. We do offer a $40 incentive for the interview, and that's in the main portion of each quarter. Our field work is designed by quarters, so we have 12-week quarters, four of them in a year. And for the 10 weeks, 1 to 10 of each quarter, what we are doing is we're just offering nothing for the screener and then $40 for the main interview. And in the final 2 weeks of each quarter, using this is a two-phase design that comes out of responsive fieldwork methodology, what we do is we take a one-third sample of the non-responders from the first 10 weeks. Either they didn't respond to the screener or they didn't respond to the main interview. And we focus our fieldwork dollars for that last 2 weeks, whatever we have left in the quarter. I mean, we basically work to within our budget, and we have the interviewers focus in on those screeners and those non-respondents to only spend their efforts on those cases. And what that does is, thankfully, brings our very sad phase one response rates up to something that we have now deemed acceptable, which 10, 15 years ago wouldn't have been, which is low 70s. Low 70s is where we are at. We used to be in the 80s, in the 90s, but those days are long gone, unfortunately. And so what we do also with the two-phase design, in addition to bringing our response rates up a little bit, we also try to address some issues of non-response bias in our survey when we adjust all that for the weighting and the variance estimation variables that we provide. So it is a cross-sectional design intended to be representative of men and women in this age range and the U.S. household population, representing in 2006 to 10, that would have been about 123 million. And as I say, this move from periodic interviewing to the continuous design did allow us to be a lot more successful within the the dollars that we have. So we got 80% more interviewers, with the cost per interview was about one-third lower than it used to be. We have roughly 5,000 cases per year being interviewed. So that was also a more productive sample yield per year. And we have more frequent data releases. So here is just a summary of the questions that we ask right now on criminal justice involvement. And it's very, very general. As you can see, it's only asked for men, which up until recently was 15 to 44, now 15 to 49. Asked in a CASI, which means it's self-administered. Don't know or refuse is always permitted, as it is for all of our questions in the survey, but our item non-response for these questions is no higher than any other questions in ACASI. One additional thing I'll say about the NSFG and the way we approach our questions, even in ACASI, is we try to avoid, based upon our consent language, anything that is self-incriminating or a question about actual perpetration of a crime. So, for example, when we do ask about, not shown here, when we ask about experience with non-voluntary sexual intercourse, we're not asking them if they perpetrated it, but only if they were the victim of it. And there's this kind of goes, this is an advanced rationalization for why we have to be very vague in these kinds of questions. But we could talk about that more it later on if it comes up. But in the last 12 months, have you spent any time in a jail, prison, or a juvenile detention facility? That's the first question. We always start with the 12-month question because so many of our questions in the NSFG are about recent risk behaviors. And so this last 12 months aligns to that. So if they say yes, okay. If they say no, then we still want to know if ever in their life they've had that experience. So we ask that. So then I keep thinking it's over here, but no, it's just the same thing as that screen. So if they said yes to either of those jail questions on the prior slide, then they are asked, have you been in jail, prison, or juvenile detention facility only one time or more than one time? And then you can see the two choices are only one time, more than one time. And then there's another question that gets asked, and what's shown there is just the two wording variants that apply depending on whether it was only one time or more than one time. So imagine that they were in jail more than one time. They would be asked, the last time you were in jail, prison, or juvenile detention, how long were you in? And then the responses are shown there. And the idea behind this was mainly just to sort of try to differentiate, even crudely, between people, among people who may have had sort of a lesser offense, and you can choose which of the ones that you saw on Art's question from before, what would be a lesser offense. But we can't, at least at the time when we were developing these questions, we could not get any much more specific than this. But so that's that. But I will also tell you, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but our reporting on these weighted estimates were much lower than what you see in the survey that was just described. And so thank you. And here's some contact information. And I would we have a general questions kind of mailbox and phone number. We have a listserv that if you want to receive any information about our reports, and then NCHS itself has a press room website that you can always see. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much. And last but not least, Catherine Porter, also from NCHS, talking about the NHANES.
Thank you very much. Greetings to everyone in the room and greetings to those who are listening remotely. So yes, indeed, we're the third survey you're going to hear about this morning that's conducted by the National Center for Health Statistics. And I'm going to talk about the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. And our purpose really is to assess the health and nutritional status of children and adults in the United States. And you've heard many surveys today already, HIS and BRFSS that do this, but what distinguishes NHANES from other surveys is we base our health estimates on direct physical measures. So the content of our survey is really driven by a health examination. Our goals are to produce population-based estimates of health conditions, and we're talking about conditions of public health importance, so diabetes, hypertension, osteoporosis. And because we can do an interview and an exam, we can really assess, do people know about their condition? Are they being treated? Another thing we can do, because we draw blood, is we can do a lot of tests for environmental exposure. So if you're interested in lead, arsenic, dioxin, we have those measures based on blood and urine collection. And we do a dietary interview so we can assess nutrition status and diet behaviors. And lastly, for those of you who might be interested, we do get permission to store specimens, so we do have a specimen repository of serum, plasma, and urine, as well as genetic material. So just in terms of data collection, as you've heard before, we are sampling the civilian, non-institutionalized household population of the United States. So we don't go into prisons, we don't go into institutions, nursing homes, et cetera. And it really is the household population. And I'd like to draw your attention to our annual sample size of those interviewed and examined. We only have 5,000 children and adults in our survey each year. And that is a small number on which to possibly get criminal justice statistics. And we've not had any questions on criminal justice involvement because of our low sample size. And we do oversample subpopulations so we can make more precise estimates in these groups. You've heard about the multi-stage sampling design of many of the surveys, and this is a graphic image that is similar to HIS and some others, but we divide the whole United States up into counties, and the counties or contiguous counties are our primary sampling units. We go to 15 counties each year just because we have to actually move these mobile exam centers, which I'll show you in a moment. But within counties, we select segments. These are block groups, and within segments, we select households. And then the final stage of selection is done at this doorstep when we actually enumerate the house, screen the household, enumerate the household, and select participants. So this is just a graphic showing you that we do send an advance letter, and there is a short screening process at the doorstep. I've highlighted just that we do inform consent prior to our interview and then afterwards prior to our exam. And the reason that I've highlighted that is I just want to show you a slide in a moment about elements of informed consent. As part of our exam, I mentioned we collect biologic specimens. Some of these are banked. Others are sent to laboratories, and all the data come back to us, and as well as a report of findings goes to the participant. So in our home interview consent, there's a lot of language that covers elements of consent, but I want to read the gold-bolded language. Health research using NHANES can be enhanced by combining your survey records with other data sources. The data gathered are used to link your answers to vital statistics, health, nutrition, and other related records. Translated, we link to mortality, we link to CMS data, Medicare, we've now linked to HUD, we've also linked to food programs. So not only do people have to agree, they have to check a box on the consent form to say, indeed, you may link our data, but I thought that might be of interest to you all. Our home interview, as you heard from other surveys, is about 1 hour, although if we get an elderly person with lots of hospitalizations, lots of medications, and lots of health problems, it can be a lot longer. But the interview also does ask our participants to show their prescription drug and supplement bottles so that we can record all the medications taken. Participants are invited to come to this mobile exam center. We have 3 of such centers. 2 are actively working at any point in time, and a third is traveling to the next location. But since maybe you've not seen these, I'd like to give you a short tour. We have a reception area where people are signed in. Our participants are asked to go straight to the restroom and change into this very fashion-forward examining wear. They're also asked to collect a urine sample that we start sending to the laboratory. We have exam rooms where we do varying things. This is an example of where we do our blood pressure assessments for cardiovascular risk factor assessment. We have in the past put people on a treadmill and assess their fitness. We do multiple exams for sensory impairments. At the top left is a picture of our audiometry component where there's a soundproof booth for pure tone audiometry. On the right, we have a young child who's using an autorefractor so we can assess visual acuity. And the center lower picture is a component that we had where we had a camera taking digital images of retina so we could assess retinal health, diabetic retinopathy, macular degeneration, and those types of things. The real bread and butter of HANES is anthropometry, that is body measurements. We are the survey known to produce objective estimates on overweight and obesity for the nation and have done so for over 50 years. On the right, you see a machine that is doing body composition, a dual X-ray absorptiometry. It's also used to do bone density of the hip and spine. We do private interviews. interviews. At the top left is an image of a dietary interview where people are asked to recall what they ate in the previous 24 hours. Not easy. We have a lot of food models so people can assess portion sizes of intake. And then the picture on the right is a private interview that we do. We assess more sensitive information, mental health, reproductive health, drug use, alcohol use, in a private interview. So we do have a room in the mobile exam center where these questions would not be appropriate to ask in a household. And we have a dentist to do our oral health exam. Last but not least, we have a laboratory. We do draw blood. We get urine. We get a lot of different specimens that's processed in our laboratory. We do in the laboratory a complete blood count and a pregnancy test, but we do mostly processing of blood, urine. We do an oral rinse. We do vaginal swabs, penile swabs, and water. And these are sent to 24 laboratories. And believe it or not, we have over 500 assays on our examined participants. It's really remarkable. So the laboratory tests, I'm not going to read these all, but we do a broad range of assessments so we can really inform the health of our population. But for this group, you might be most interested in the infectious diseases that we're measuring, including sexually transmitted infections. Response rates. Well, I can sing the same song that you've heard from previous presenters. Earlier, we enjoyed very high response rates. If you just focus on the gold bolded line. Several years ago, we were in the high 70 percentages, but that's declined. So our most recent 2015 survey ended with a response rate of 63%. And for this, that sounds good for surveys as a whole, but for Haynes, it is a little bit disappointing. All right, so we do a lot of work in our division to prepare data for public use release, and I just want to comment that there is a confidentiality review. We have strict federal legislation that calls for protection of PII and indirect PII for our participants, so we make sure that whatever goes out for public use, there's no disclosure risk, and for those that where there is a possible disclosure risk, we keep that in our research data center. This is just a picture showing our website where you can download data to use Haynes, and I just wanted to mention that we release our data in two-year cycles. So when you think about adding content to Haynes, our instrument is locked for 2 years, so we have planning efforts for a two-year content. So new content, how can we work together? Really, it's an open invitation to all of our collaborators. We have over 30 collaborators that work with us at the moment, federal government, universities, private sectors. We even have content that's generated internally from our program. And we have a two-year timeline. So if we do work together, we'd be working toward a January 19 start for the 1920 survey. And it would essentially start very soon. Questionnaire content we'll be asking for in March of 2017. Exam content we'll be asking for this September of 2016. And we need 2 years to really vet content because we have to do pilot tests, we have to do cognitive testing, we need clearances and translations and lots of work, but it is doable to work together. So in conclusion, I'm again delighted to give you an overview of the survey. And again, we have a very small sample size. I don't know if this would be a useful data source for you to understand criminal justice statistics, but we're glad to be here and talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much to all the panel, the speakers. It was terrific. Really, really helpful. So just to start discussion, I'll point out just a few things that are immediately obvious just to say it so they're out there and we don't have to re-rehearse them. But it's very clear that each of these surveys has its own agenda and its own constituencies, right? Its own core functions. They have different sampling processes and sizes. They have different administration modes and different measures along the way. So it's really quite a range. It's also clear that response rates are a challenge for every survey, not just these, but that is a real issue to think about. And the length and burden are really serious issues for each survey. And so as we think about potentially adding something somewhere, we really have to keep that in mind, that there are really serious challenges facing each of these surveys and their core constituencies. And it also, only some of the surveys now have any current measurement of criminal justice involvement in any way. So what it would mean to make any proposals for changes to any of them is going to be different in each case. So that's think the obvious things to start with. I would love to offer it up for speakers based on your experience yesterday and the discussions to have any ruminations you currently have about where things are standing with your survey. I think yesterday we were looking at what would be desirable to measure, right, from the perspective of this group. And today we're starting to look at the reality of what's currently being measured on the ground and what would it take to make any moves in any direction. So it'd be great to hear any thoughts you currently have.
I wasn't here yesterday.
Well, I guess I can start. Yeah, we've been, I guess over the years, there's just been various redesigns of different magnitudes. And really, the last redesign we had was last year, 2015. It started in late 2007, 2008. So it took a period of years to get to where we are now with this new redesign. And it was actually in two phases. First phase was a sample redesign in 2014. To reflect what you saw there, it resulted in more precise estimates because we kind of changed the sampling so that it's more proportionate to the population. But more importantly, we changed some of the questionnaire content. We expanded the prescription drug module significantly, but it's a zero-sum game, so we had to take out some what we thought were important modules. So we had a big marijuana marketing module. We had a module that's used to determine industry and occupation of respondents, so that had to be removed to accommodate these new questions. One thing I should say is that what we've learned over time is that, you know, you've heard all this talk about rotating modules. That's something that we thought about and actually we didn't really do, but we in the past we did kind of put in modules, take out, but not on a frequent basis. And we found it was problematic. In 2008, I'll just give you a quick example. Because of SAMHSA's interest in adding more mental health content, we actually added a depression module in 2004, and then in 2008 we had to add a module to measure serious psychological distress, but we needed to have an impairment module. To get at that definition. So we had to juggle some things around. We had to shorten the module that measures SMI to just K6 and take out some questions and add some other questions. And so when we produced our 2008 estimates, we found out that the module that we changed, which came right before the depression module, well, depression estimates changed because there were context effects, significant context effects, and that's for a whole module. We found that few years back for just changing one question in a module that was looking at perceptions. You know, it was, how do you feel about adults trying cigarettes in a certain time period? And we had subsequent questions about marijuana. We took out the cigarette questions, and it changed the whole distribution over the next year. So context effects is a big problem in our survey. And so we just can't go in and just take out a module and put it back in, rotated models is going to have significant implications. And since trends is an important indicator, or important measure for us, we have to be very careful about that. We feel that best approach, of course, there's obviously other approaches, but we feel the best approach, if you want to add, you know, expand the criminal involvement section or, you know, add more questions, I think ultimately the best approach is just to integrate those questions right into that module, not put it at the end of the survey or any other place. And the reason I say this is because for NISDA, the way the questions are administered, it's a household survey. It's computer administered, but it's really two types of computer administration. The first is computer administered personal interviews. We first have the interviewers ask questions, basic demographic information, that sort of thing. Then we turn the laptop over to the respondent. The respondent fills out the bulk of the, you know, the instrument themselves because of a lot of sensitive questions. But then the laptop is turned back over to the interviewer to finish out the questions. And so to add at the end, you know, a new module, whatever it is, especially if it's something that's related to something that was asked early on, we're not sure what could happen. It could have fatigue effects. It could be, you know, response to asking, what is this doing here? You just asked about questions early on. Now it's, you know, you're back asking additional questions. It may be a little awkward, and we've experienced a little bit of that because of the fact that through experience, as I just mentioned, that there we had problems adding questions, so we had to be consistent. We once had a term that we call core modules and non-core, and the core was the basic drug use modules, and then we had a non-core section, and so we found that when we added some questions on, I think when Adderall and Ambien was kind of jumping off, and a few years back we added some questions and not in a core section, but later on. We also, I think in 2006 when NIAAA changed their definition of binge drinking to 4+ for females. Yeah, and we had the 5+. But we didn't want to put it into the alcohol module because of fear of affecting trends. So we move it, we put it in the module later on. But we found that we got inconsistent responses. So and we couldn't use the data. We can only use it when we actually redesigned the questions in 2015. We actually put that question into the alcohol module. So these are kind of the challenges we face when we're talking about adding questions. There's a lot of anticipated things, but there's also a lot of unanticipated things that could occur. And we need to just be careful about that.
Art, can I ask you a question really quick? Regarding the criminal justice questions that you do have in the survey now, were they always there, or do you have any information or insight into how the survey and the response rates were affected when they were added?
I really don't know. That happened. Okay. I mean, it was 1991.
Oh, okay.
At that time, we had a person on board in the office that had a criminal justice background, and she recognized the scarcity of information about the intersection between drug use and criminal involvement. Mm-hmm. At that point, we didn't have anything. Mm-hmm. So we had basic questions on, I think it was just three, have you been arrested, and then questions on parole and probation.
Right.
And that was on for a few years. And then we decided to partner with BJS in the mid-1990s, and that's when we added those specific offenses.
Okay, I was going to ask that too, about the degree of specificity to which you go in that. Mm-hmm. The question about the specific types of crime,
right.
What the motivation was behind getting down into those details.
Yeah, it's just trying to mimic after what was there from the FBI's list of offenses. And also we wanted to kind of, by looking at their data, UCR data, Uniform Crimes Report, thank you, data, to get an idea of kind of the prevalence of how frequently they occur. If it was rare, we didn't want to put it on there because we even though we had a large sample, back in those days it was large, but not as large as it is now. And still, we still have some challenges even with the largest sample. We wanted to try to, just subset to just those offenses that we feel we can measure mm-hmm. pretty well. I didn't mention this, but we also had a few other questions on DUI, driving under the influence of alcohol, driving under influence of illicit drugs, and then the combination. And then there are a few other questions as well.
One of the things that concerns me, and this is not just the health interview survey, but all surveys, but I'll focus on household-based surveys, non-response bias is a serious problem, especially as our response rates decline. There are households that you know nothing about because they summarily refuse or you can't contact them, and you're not really sure how those affect your estimates. But then there are the households that we do get the screening or the family component where we enumerate the household residents and know age, sex, race, and a number of other pieces of information about them. And when it comes to the sample adult being randomly selected for the more detailed interview, the group with the largest non-response are young adult males, especially minorities. And this, I think, is pretty universal to household surveys. So when you think about, something that's relatively rare event to begin with, and then you have, undercoverage of a serious level, it affects the percentages, obviously, but it also the overall number of observations that you're going to get on such a population. And that's a really big concern for me. And I'm not sure if any of the other surveys want to comment on that issue.
Yes, what Marcy said, but I think even you have to be suspicious of the responses you're getting from those who are responding. And in our survey in particular, I think the context has always been, you're in a safe place, you can tell us anything, nothing bad will happen to you when you know, we're not going to go tell on you, we're not going to go link your data, you're not going to do this and that. And it sounds like, I wasn't here for all of any of it yesterday, but it sounds like there is some interest or need to link and to be able to evaluate in some way what the survey data tell you in conjunction with other data. And that act of linkage, I think, undercuts, and maybe for justifiable reasons, but it does undercut the responses that we're getting now. And I think Art also mentioned another major concern that we have, or a challenge that we've had with the NSFG with this. We've talked a lot over the years about this idea of adding questions in kind of a separate segregated area in modules, whether we actually call them modules or not, but we tried to avoid any kind of interference with our time series and our long-term measurement of various important core topics. But the very act of putting them out in their own little island changes the context of what you're not leveraging the content of the survey that would have surrounded those questions and made them make sense. But at the same time, you're protecting that other content. So I think that those are just challenges that have to be balanced. But the other thing I wanted to just add, since others had mentioned it as well, and I wasn't 100% clear on it when I spoke earlier, we have a very similar time frame for making questionnaire changes as I think NHANES does. The way that our contract and our field work is organized, we try to do things every second year. So under the current contract, we have at least one more iteration of that change opportunity, which is for the survey that will field starting in September 2017. And we're in the process actually this year of trying to make sure we get some of those kinds of suggestions in place and thought through so that we can implement them for September 2017. And after that, it's really the new contract. So we are nearing the end of a 10-year contract with our current contractor. So we would need to sort of redo that whole process and write a new RFP, et cetera, and award a new contract. And in that new contract, I think things are a little bit more open-ended in terms of what could be thought about, and our minds are a little bit more open, I guess. But within the current contract, we're very limited in the current design for the survey and the current questionnaire layout, essentially.
All right. Wayne, are you still on the phone?
I am.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yeah. Just in case you had anything to say, feel free to with your very large sample size of 450,000, by the way.
So I think a couple of things that I would just comment on. One is, as with everyone, space, particularly space on the core survey, is just premium, and so it is really hard to get. I think if folks were interested in getting questions on the core survey, I think the coordinators are very concerned about the length of the survey, and so really something needs to come off in order for things to get on, particularly the annual core survey. So I think that's important. I also think that I agree with the comments earlier about the context around where questions are. As we do our rotating modules and other things, they tend to be in the same place year after year. So, you know, we've got the physical activity questions frequently right after the nutrition questions. So that order tends to be relatively constant. I think that sort of helps in terms of not seeing a lot of bouncing around from one year to the next in terms of content. The other thing I did want to mention, just if there is interest in potentially adding questions to the BRFS, we actually have the coordinators in town today talking about the 2017 survey. So it's going to be, 2017 is pretty much closed off. So the earliest we could think about adding, you know, one to five or how many questions you guys were thinking about would be sometime for the 2018 BRFS. And we will be coming out with a query, and Dr. Towne can work with you all. We will be coming out with a query this fall. So if people are interested, just let us know, and we'll include you in that process.
Great. Thank you, Wayne. Jody had a question.
Actually, I want to three sort of questions or challenges. And this has been really a wonderful description of all these all this hard work that's gone on, and you know, sort of frustrating that it's going to take many years to get some answers. I'm wondering if highlighting the fact that we're really missing predominantly African American men who are often not in homes and not in maybe not have phones. But this kind of three things. There was mention of partnering with BJS, and I think, you know, the BJS has this NCRP national database of prisoners in all states, essentially. And I'm wondering for each of your studies, and particularly for N. Haynes, I want to challenge you to think about perhaps figuring out a way to link that, because if you had, it wouldn't be jailed populations generally, is that right? Yeah, but use that and the Federal Bureau of Prisons database, you could look at your 5,000 a year and really tease out those who are have a history of incarceration, at least recently. Maybe validate some of the questions you have about incarceration. You may pick up a lot of people that said, oh, yeah, no, I've never been incarcerated, and get a sense of error there. And also really just use that to drill down on the population. I mean, I would be very interested in looking at HIV prevalence, hepatitis prevalence, and your other 500 tests. So I think that's a potential very useful collaboration. The second thing is I'm wondering again about N. Haynes. You know, could you take your N. Haynes truck into a subsample of correctional populations and just study them in the same way that you study the general population to get a sense of how different they are? But I would extend that to, I think, all the studies to see if you would think about doing surveys in representative correctional populations, just as a, you know, you can kind of get a sense of the differences between this mostly household population and this missing population. And the third thing is, you know, yesterday we talked a lot about the health effects of incarceration, and I think there's probably nothing more dramatic than people who overdose from opiates after release from incarceration because they've lost their tolerance. And now that we are right in the midst of an opiate use disorder epidemic, I'm wondering if, to what extent each of your studies is looking at opiate use disorder and overdose in your populations, either alone or in relation to incarceration. Thanks.
I could start off, for those on the phone, it's Catherine again. The last question first, in terms of opioid use, we have analyzed our prescription drug data looking back 10 years. We've seen an increase in prescription opioid use, not a lot. It's gone from 4% to 6% over the past 10 years. But what is really interesting is when you drill down as to the type of opioid, whether it's stronger than morphine, just as equivalent to morphine or weaker than morphine, the proportion of people taking opioids that are stronger than morphine has really increased. So we're talking about the Vicodins, we're talking about the Oxycontins. That's been a remarkable finding. The second thing you mentioned is sending mobile exam centers to prisons. So our charge is really to study the household population. So this would be a true departure to look at institutions that I don't know if our authorizing legislation would justify. But it doesn't mean that we can't work with a group, if it's a private sector contractor, that is funded by another federal agency to share our methods, our protocols, everything. So you wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel at all. And we've done that with, for example, just New York City wanted to do their own New York City Hanes. And we worked very closely with them and got them off the ground. They, in fact, have done 2 surveys to date. So we wouldn't actually be doing it, but we would be happy to share everything that we do. The last thing is the linkage to possible databases. You know, Hanes did have a query in the past in 2011 to add questions about incarceration in the past 12 months and then look at that population to see if they could be described. And we just didn't have the sample size. I mean, if I mentioned we have 5,000 each year, maybe 3,000 will be adults. And if they're 2.5% that have ever been incarcerated, ever, if you take that down to 12 months, that we just didn't have the sample size to describe that. And I'm wondering if that would be true for linkages too. But, you know, you certainly can combine a lot of years. And if it takes 10 years of Hanes data with linkages, we can talk about that. So I guess the proposal of adding linkage to NHANES would really be drilling down as to what the research question would be that you want to answer and see if we have the statistical power to do that.
Any other responses to?
So in terms of the opioid use, we have a, actually I should mention, I didn't mention a presentation that with the adding the new questions in 2015 actually broke trends for all of our prescription drugs. We really expanded the prescription drug module significantly. There's 4 therapeutic classes, including pain relievers, and we added a lot more drugs, including methadone and Vicodin. There's a whole bunch of drugs we added. But in terms of trends, we've been seeing declines in prescription opioid use in general. But what's been increasing has been use among those who use frequently. You know, those that use 20 more days in a month, or 300 days in a year. That's going up. So it's still a problem. We do capture opioid disorder based on DSM-4. Criteria, so we do have that, and we've been doing that for years. But again, the trends have been broken. But still, we have from 2014 back to 2002, we have consistent data collection to measure to do a lot of good analysis there. In terms of the surveys and prison population, I just want to echo what Catherine's saying. I don't think our mandate really covers our ability to go into those populations and. I think also I'm not sure in terms of the analytic purpose, we would no longer be able to get population-based estimates. It would be, the unit of analysis would be the prison population of sorts. So it would be, some limitations. But certainly we're welcome to, offer our expertise and questionnaires available on the line, any information you need that would be helpful. There. In terms of linkages, not really sure. We've done linkages in the past, not with prison population data, but with mortality data, both direct linkages and indirect linkages. We recently did a study looking at our mortality where we linked not by person. We didn't want to do that. We linked by demographic information and then looked at that relevant to we're looking at suicides, suicides and looking at that relative to folks in the NISDA that said that they had suicidal thoughts, plans, and attempts. So we've done direct and indirect linkages there. So that's all I want to say.
We have one more time for one more. I hate to cut it short, but then we're not going to give other folks, and everyone will stay around and still talk. Okay, good.
I have a question, and if we can't answer it during this panel, then maybe sometime throughout the day, but I wanted to pose it while our speakers for this panel were here. Our group has expressed an interest in data linkages, and I wanted to know if you could talk about some of the process and the time that goes into linking your survey to another data set, in particular if it's a non-HHS data set, because that process can take several years just to get the agreements in place, and just so that our group has an understanding of, if we're thinking of low-hanging fruit, it's something that data linkages can be very important, but it's also not a quick fix. I mean, there's a lot that goes into that. So if at some point during the day, if you're still here, if you can just talk a few minutes about how some of that might work, that would be helpful for us.
And I think some of that will be covered during the next session that John is facilitating. So hopefully we'll get a chance to do that. So.
Amanda will talk about that in the missing chair.
Okay.
The empty chair will talk about
that. Wonderful. Okay, I want to give everybody a chance for a short 15-minute break. I know there's some important sessions coming up. So if everyone could really try to be ready and back by 5 to 11, I'm sorry to hold everyone to these strict lines, but I appreciate that. Thank you. And thank you to all our wonderful speakers.
Thank you, Wayne.